Good morning. And welcome. It's my privilege to be able to introduce to you this morning our district president in residence, Dr. David Behnke. Dr. Behnke was born and raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He's the grandson of South Wisconsin District President J.F. Berger and great-grandson of Reverend Friedrich of Western Wisconsin, who came to the United States as a result of William Leah and founded 21 parishes in Wisconsin. He has two brothers, Mike and Bob, who are St. Louis grads and LCMS pastors. Dr. Behnke is a product of Lutheran Grade School, Concordia Prep and Junior College in Milwaukee, Senior College graduate of 1968, a graduate of Concordia Seminary here in 1972, with an extra year of Old Testament studies in 73. He received the D.M.in degree from New York Theological Seminary in 1983 and the LL.D. from Concordia Bronxville in 1997. He's married to his wife Judy, and they were married in 1968, and his wife is currently a church and community counselor in Mount Vernon, New York. Pastor Behnke served a variety of congregations, large and small, as a parish pastor for 19 years. He was elected as district president in 1991 and has been serving as district president in the Atlantic District since then. He is also author of a book from Concordia Publishing House, and he indicated there's still copies available, so he wants to encourage a lot of you to buy it. And he'll explain that. Recently, he's also become somewhat of a celebrity, as I've seen his picture on one of our church periodicals that happens to come to our campus about once a month, and his picture's always right there on the front page. So let's welcome Dr. David Behnke.
Good morning. It's great to be with you, and we live in hopeful and expectant times. I'd like to begin by sharing a little story about a group that I am active in New York. I was one of the co-founders in a collaborative effort called Pregnancy Help, Crisis Pregnancy Center in Manhattan, which is, relatively speaking, the capital of abortion in the United States. And every year we have a prayer service in Advent, and I give greetings, of course, from the Missouri Synod side. And the last time I was there, a beautiful thing happened, which I'll share with you as a way to say we live in hopeful and expectant times, is that just as I was finishing my words of greeting, in from the back came a woman with three children, three babies in her arms, triplets. And it turned out that just, 10 months prior, or 8 months prior, whatever, she was considering having an abortion. And was there with our counselors. The counselor in that place has been a Lutheran woman and made the great decision to go on with her pregnancy. And I thought that was an amazing triple blessing. You know, when we talk about Advent expectation, to me that was the high point of my whole Advent. And that year was to see those three babies come wheeling into the building. So there are things that God is doing, even in places where it seems like it's tough, for the sake of his kingdom. I'd like to speak to you today on three levels, the personal, the pastoral, and the presidential, and then leave it open for questions at the end on any one of those levels. And to start with the personal, I am a seminary graduate of this very institution. This at that time was the chapel, as some of you would know and remember. And it was a turbulent, tumultuous time. I left here about 3 months before what we call the explosion. One of my seminal experiences in that era was across the hall in SEEK. And at the time, it was another cultural period, an epoch, late 60s, early 70s, and we had on campus at that time speaking. I remember walking into SEEK 102 there, about 200 of us, and in marched with armed guards with him, Bobby Seale from the Black Panthers. The usual campus visitor, remember the Black Panthers? Bobby Seale. And Bobby Seale said one thing that always has stuck with me, is his opening remark. And this is a powerful guy. He went through some extremely difficult times there in this country. And he said, "I've been before Congress. I have stood before the leaders of this country. I've been before civic leaders all over the country. And he said, I'm looking out here this morning and I've never spoken to a more powerful group than I am right now. This group right here, you, 100, 200 of us over in Sikh. And it just drilled into my chest. I said, what in the, thinking as a, you know, fourth year seminarian, huh? What? Me? What are you talking about? What do we know? And it comes to me down the ear, of course, that he was a left-handed guy. He was thinking of the kingdom of the left hand and how much power we would have out in communities for the force of good, for the civil righteousness, to make a difference in our societies and around in the communities that we would be in. And how at a much deeper level, on a profound level, he was absolutely right theologically, although he didn't know it, because you are an extraordinarily powerful group if you understand that the local altar is the very place where God's grace breaks through onto the planet Earth. And the most powerful locations in the universe are those local altars to which you will be called. That is absolutely true. It is absolutely right, and it is absolutely God's power at the heart of it. I went through a period of time when I made a decision to disremember this place, to disassociate from it, and in my mind there was a difference between what happens today and what happened to us in 1972 and 3. I actually left in 73, right after the New Orleans Convention. You go out as those who are sent with authority. It's missio, to be sent with authority. There's another kind of going out which should be called to be expelled, to be kicked out by the authorities. Now, some were expelled, okay. I wasn't expelled. We were propelled. And we were propelled from this place and sort of spit out, in my case, spit out exactly as Jonah on the shores of Nineveh, that great and evil city of New York. And I marched to its center after 3 days and said, repent. There's an ambiguity for my being here, in my being here, because when you come back to a place, there is a remembrance and a reconnection and a reaffiliation, and it tosses up a lot of things inside the heart of hearts, and all of the Eucharistic celebrations that I went to here are coming back to me as I am here, and all of the precious relationships. The incredible freedom that we had of that time of expression and of thought and exploration, the exhilarating boldness of action, the incredibly tight friendships which were sent just out into the wind because of the way we were propelled from this place in that era, in that time. And in those days, there was no internet. There was really extraordinarily high long-distance rates, so as soon as we left, we, and in many cases, lost touch with people that we were tight with, as I was, at least in the Missouri Synod system, for 12, 14 years. I'd gone to school with these folks. Some of them I went to grade school with. I'd been in school with one guy here for 20 years when I left here. Imagine that's longer than many marriages. To me, at that time, there was an inordinate value in teachable moments and the presence of Christ and the Spirit in them. And I believe that to be at the heart of what we did this morning and at the heart of what you will do. I pray on a weekly basis in your congregations in the celebration of the Holy Eucharist. And that is to remember this, as Jesus said, remember this in the context of your existence. And how important it was in retrospect to me to listen, both here and in my parish ministry. And in order to most appropriately translate the scandal into the scandal of the specific, where I was spit up there in New York, the scandal of the cross. That's really what ministry is all about, is to translate the scandal of the specific that you will find, and that you are finding in your life, into the scandal of the cross. We were tremendously culturally bound, kids in my era, not like you, culturally free. You know, our icons were Abby Hoffman, you know, lunatics on the left. And you got Rush Limbaugh, you know. Ouch. And yet beneath it to us was the joy of risk, of letting go of your life in service of the great gospel cause, which is the same exact thing that you are called to do today. The culture, and you're living in a culture of eliminating risk, of covering your posterior, of setting bounds, and of people setting incredible bounds today. And yet you're entering the fray with the same risk, the same letting go, the same getting after the mission. So that's on the personal side, just to let you know who I am and kind of where I've come from in my journey back here this week. And then connected to what I found here, I will say I found just a great 3 days here, getting to know you, hanging out in the softball field and in the gym, and with Mrs. Groudon down there selling off much furniture, and being in the library and making noise in the basement the way I always did, and hanging out in the dining hall. All of the things just brought back tremendous memories to me and showed me who you are, and in listening to you, what this place is all about. I will say that on a personal level, I found in friendships here, tremendous support system. And maybe that's the thing that's different, because I had been to school with so many people for so long that there was a real deep support system among collegial way and among students in that era. Whereas today, I think some of you don't have a long relationship of friendship with one another. You meet, you come here, and you're in it. And yet I find now there to be a tremendously enhanced support system from the seminary. There was no food bank when we were here, man. None of that stuff. There was a lot different ambiance here. The support system for families is incredibly increased here. And the attention paid to the family here is just on a 1 to 10, about a 38 from when I was here. The attention paid to couples and to marriages here is tremendously enhanced. And you may think there are gaps, and some of you have shared with me that there are gaps and that there are still difficulties and that there are groups of people like teenage kids would be tough here when some of you are moving 3-4 times in 5 years. To bring children that are a little older into that setting is awfully difficult on those kids, and it felt to me like maybe that support system can be enhanced. But there is a tremendous support here. I will say that what I heard you saying to me was that there needs, on a personal level, that there needs to be a more open attitude of outside folks to come into the campus and be involved with you, that you need to hear more from us, not only district presidents, but people from the districts you come from. You need to be more in contact, more in touch with the outside, so to speak, outside world, off-campus world, and that would help. It would really help you to feel connected in that way. Now, the other one was just to me listening to you in class and how I felt like there would be encumbrance on discussion here. I had a sense of that, and there wasn't. And there isn't. And that there's a sense here that you can freely explore ideas, that you can freely explore the boundaries of confessional substance in this setting, and do so in a spirit of collegiality and not CYA and not worrying about what is said. If that is happening, that is great. The classes I attended, that was happening, and it was great. And I think the fine line continues to need to be drawn between the academic life and the formational life. They are one and the same, and yet there can be a feeling from the student's perspective that it's mostly academic and not much formation. And that, to me, is important for me to listen to in you, that your sincere desire is to be servants of the church. That's what I've heard. I've heard it loud and clear, and I'll take that back. The East Coast, because of the same turbulence that happened in my life 25 years ago out there, has a culture of suspicion toward anything from the Midwest. And guess what? That's reciprocal. There's usually speaking a culture of suspicion in the Midwest about anything in the East. And this that goes a long way in my heart of hearts to breaking that down and to saying we are one body, we are one loaf, and we are headed in one direction in mission and service to Lord and church. So that's what I heard. That's on the personal level. The second is the pastoral level. And in that regard, I'd like to speak to you for a couple minutes about the importance of integrity in service of the mission.
which is my pastoral, the impetus for pastoral ministry in my experience. And I would like to say to you then very carefully that integrity cannot begin with you, or we're in deep trouble, that integrity needs to begin in the heart of God, and God's integrity for us, the integrity of God's mission to us and in us is where we must begin. Confessional integrity to me is extremely important out in the parish, and I found it to be absolutely true in an inner city parish in Brooklyn, where I served for like 17 years. I see a parishioner here. I found it to be true in interesting ways, in that it forced me, and I hope the parish forces you in the same way, to your absolute roots and the depths of your theological commitment. And the depths of my commitment are rooted and anchored in this simple statement that Lutheran theology is dynamic and relational. The heart of Lutheran confessional theology is always dynamic and always relational. Beneath all propositions, it is dynamic, relational, and if I could add another word, mysterious. And those are givens inside of our theological documents. To me, the dynamic nature is that, and the relational nature, the personal nature, is that God is always in action pro nobis, that it is not a theological treatise about God, but a God who is in action for me, on behalf of me, propter Christum, that there is never a chance, there is never a way and a place in which God is not in relation, in a dynamic relationship toward me. I'll borrow from a recent article in First Things by the Jesuit Avery Dulles, who speaks about the tradition in context of worship. And he says, and I believe this as well, that we are authentically traditional because we only preach and do and practice what we have received. That is what tradition means, dealing with that which you have received. And what we receive, first of all, is what God has passed on, that God gave up his Son, and that the Son was given over into death for us, passed into death for us, so that the Spirit might be called and delivered unto us. And that dynamic action of God on our behalf is what forms my pastoral impetus. I act and I do in the same dynamics and in the same context of relating to people, relating the gospel to people in the way that has happened to me. And the way I have perceived that is through the great passing on of the mystery of the Trinity into me through holy baptism. And then the great celebration of that same mystery in the presence of Christ in his meal. Just as a passing reference, so we just had a conference, a theological convocation on the Trinity in the Atlantic District. And we did so because we believe the doctrine of the Trinity is in some quarters under attack. But more than that, that's a negative reason to do something. We believe that the dynamics of Trinitarian theology are of absolutely primary importance in proclaiming the gospel in this age, in this secular age, in this post-Constantinian age, in this age without roots, in this age when we confront world religions at our doorstep every day. And the way that I presented the paper was to say that one of the and I saw it here in chapel a little bit, even though it's a custom and it's an external thing and it is not at the root and the heart of everything, but the making of the sign of the cross, I believe to be extremely important. The founder, Luther, thought that we should do it at least twice a day in the home, and I would agree with him. And I would agree that in our parishes, if pastors are going out and encouraging people to make the sign of the cross in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, that there is an explosion in God's own way of Trinitarian power there that is available for us. At any rate, that was off the topic a little bit. The idea was that whatever obscures or detracts or replaces confessional integrity, whether it's you, which is the greatest danger, you and your own persona, or some gimmick, which often happens, or some concept like canned grace, some kind of ex opere operato thing, where just by saying the right words, absent relationship, good things will happen. Formula One. Or moralizing tendencies, which I find in preaching all over not only the Atlantic District but the Missouri Synod, in a place where we don't have any excuse because we know better. People are preaching law to the exclusion of gospel, or shallow law to the exclusion of deep law, or law as false comfort, or tips for the holy, rather than getting to the gospel. And I will say this just straight ahead, that is in the way of the means of grace. That's getting in the way. Don't do it. Whatever obscures or detracts or replaces, and that means worship is an important issue for us. How we worship, how we prepare for worship, how we deal with holy things, how we prepare people to receive holy things. And yet all else can be risked for the sake of those ultimates. And that was a word I wanted to say so strongly to you today, is not to be afraid to take all risks you can, personally and even in your family, for the sake of those ultimates. Because the time is short and because the opportunity is so great. I'm in one of the greatest opportunity zones on the planet Earth, New York City, as far as world mission. The county of Queens is the most diversely populated county by race, ethnicity, and religion in the United States, possibly in the world. And I live there. And every day it comes right up at me and grabs me by the throat and gives me a shot to proclaim that gospel in a way that I hadn't before. My goal in pastoral ministry, a personal prayer every day, was to put someone in my way who had not yet heard the good news or was not connected to a fellowship of believers. And I can tell you that if you do that, that the Lord will honor that. He honored it for me and gave me just beaucoup opportunities, many of which I blew, you know, as a human being, but many of which God blessed. I've been asked to, in many quarters, talk about the Nehemiah Plan, which was something that happened in my pastoral ministry. And it was a collaborative effort. I don't use the word ecumenical anymore. It doesn't have any legs, or it gets me in trouble. But this was a collaborative thing. A bunch of Christian denominations, mostly Roman Catholic and Episcopal and Lutheran and a whole side dish of others, who banded together to do something in housing. And I'll tell you, I've spoken about it from a housing perspective. I've spoken about it from a mission perspective, because we did this for the sake of expanding our mission opportunities. But really, in my heart of hearts, it was a pastoral perspective that led me to be active in building what became 2,500, 3,500 single-family homes, and around the country about $1 billion in housing in inner-city areas. The story behind the story is that the first national denomination to kick in this project was the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which had never done anything like it. And it happened in a little church basement in Brooklyn. And I was privileged to be the one who gave the command performance speech to ask for $1 million. And that was B.S. bucks before Schwann. That was when $1 million was still $1 million, you know. People said, how did you get enough energy, muster enough courage to speak on that topic? And I'll tell you how, from a pastor's perspective. Because the week before that, in fact, the 2 days before that, I had done a burial of a parishioner who had been, it's hard to talk about it, even 15 years later, is that she had been raped, bound and gagged in her own house, and then whoever was the person doing this had dosed her with kerosene and then set the whole house on fire on top of her. And she survived, this woman, a good German stock. She survived for 2 months in a burn ward. And she had been, her house was burned right there in the middle of that neighborhood that was burning to the ground at that time. It was of the enemy, completely of the enemy. And so, having just ministered to her what was there of her in that burn ward, and then seen someone who had lived through hell on earth, literally hell on earth. And then seen at her funeral, the signs of hope in the resurrection, there was in my heart at that time when I had to make the little speech to Ed Westcott, this burning in a different direction, this burning vision that this cannot happen to God's people, that this should not happen to anyone, and that if God gave us the strength and the courage to knit together for once against the grain in an internet and a national effort that could bring national money to bear from various denominations in a way to rebuild that community, that on the ashes of her house we would build one of those homes. I had no trouble speaking truth to power in that moment because it was a pastoral thing for me. It came from a different place inside of me. And it was blessed, and it happened, and the Missouri Synod got rich and famous, and the local congregation got rich and famous, and people were, and at a deeper level and all of that, profoundly affected in their lives. And the result of it was that a house was built there on her empty lot, and the other result was that people were baptized and brought into the kingdom of God. Including a guy from Barbados, and now I'll risk again, they're taping this, which is a terrible thing for me, but I'll risk another little story that might take you from a pastoral perspective into risking a few things. One of the men that came into the church at that time, his name was Gerald Holder, he's from Barbados, and he became one of those who wanted to buy one of those homes. And right in the middle of that prospect, he said, I need to be baptized. He had taken membership courses. And he came, I'm ready for baptism. And he said, the only thing, Pastor, is that in Barbados, when we do a baptism, we do it in the river. We do it in the water, and we do it by immersion. He said, and I know that we don't have to be immersed. He said, but I want to be immersed. I need that. I'd like that. Could you do that? Now, what do? You're the pastor in the field. You're out there. What's your response? We don't have immersion baptism. No, I didn't say that. I said, Gerald, man, I said, the problem is it's March. We ain't going to the river. It's too cold. I said, but if we can find a place, we'll do it by immersion. And we took the whole congregation over to the Highland Park Y, which had a swimming pool. This was only a couple blocks away. And we brought them over and lit all the candles in the swimming pool and put them under the waves. And the power of baptismal life in that moment was extremely strong. And many visitors were there. And he began to bring people so that in 1 year after he moved into those Nehemiah homes, he had brought almost 60 adults into the congregation. All right, now that to me was a sign that the impetus of the pastoral heart, the pastoral urge in the impetus was what began the thing for me. And that was honored, and it did not lose any integrity because it was of God. I can give you, after a while, if you want to know the secret of immersion baptism, how to make them, what do you do in an adult immersion baptism? I was taught by the Baptists on this, and I have the exact way to hold, I have that down. If you need to know that for future reference, we can talk about that one later. At any rate, I found, and this is a pastoral word to you, that there is a great beauty and a great mystery to the profound levels of Lutheran truth in ministry among people of all backgrounds, of all races, and of all religions. And the beauty in the midst of a Calvinistic country, in the midst of a syncretistic society, in the midst of a group of people who say, I do religion my way, the Frank Sinatra school of religion, is that our stuff works. We have a ministry in Manhattan, Life's Journey, in which in the first couple of years, one of the things they did, they just bought up a whole stock of Walther's Law and Gospel, started to give it out in the stock market, and they found people left and right coming in and saying, this is true. This is the truth. Why haven't I seen this before? We have a ministry in Manhattan, Life's Journey, in which in the first couple of years, one of the things they did, they just bought up a whole stock of Walther's Law and Gospel, started to give it out in the stock market, and they found people left and right coming in and saying, this is true. This is the truth. Why haven't I seen this before? And as soon as we got a chance to bring that truth out into the marketplace in that setting, we found out that it read well, it interiorized well, and it gave opportunity for Bible study, baptism, and life in the body. The sacramental, the practice of the sacraments in the parish, I believe to be so important. And I will say this again, as some of you go out to Baptist Heaven out in Oklahoma or Texas or something, or some of you go into other areas where there's strong Pentecostal fervor, where I was in a Hispanic neighborhood, the Pentecostal church started about every 5 minutes. Really. They came by once and they offered to buy our place, one of the guys, and he said, I'll offer you a good price. And I said, well, we're using it Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. I said, but you're welcome to rent it any other day than those. You know, and the guy said, oh, you have a living church. I was looking for a dead one. And I passed him on to a church down the block. I figured he could buy it. I think he did buy one. But what against all that? See, against the incredible legalism of some of those traditions is when we offer this meal and we offer this altar call. We have a tremendous altar call. And I used to teach it just as that, because people would come in, they said, you have an altar call. I said, oh yeah, ours is better than anybody's. I said, you come up and you get something. You receive something. You're going to receive forgiveness. You're going to receive strength. You're not going to leave your all on the altar. You're going to get something. You're going to get everything at the altar. Receive everything at the altar. And people profoundly are affected by that. People without high degree of education, high degree of religious background, or a religious background that is far different from the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. This stuff works, and it works because it's truth. Okay. The next level is just to talk for a moment about the personal level in you for continued growth and formation in the field and for the kind of friendships and the kind of interrelationships you'll need and the kind of personal devotional life you'll need. And I'm not going to go into that in detail except to say it would be absolutely wrong of me to stand here before you and tell you anything other than be sure you are doing those things with your family and yourself, that your own practice of word and sacrament for yourself is key in every day of your life, because you will be tempted above that you think you are able. God is greater than all that, but you will be tempted. And then inside of that is to me a great need on the part of pastors today to be able to translate, to be able translators. And that is to take all the wonderful things you are learning here and be able to translate them into the vernacular. I have questions as to whose job that is. Who helps you do that, see? Who helps you take 16th century language and concepts and thoughts and put them into words that Joe Schmidt out there in the pew can understand? Who helps you to deal with people on a personal level using all of the great Lutheran theological terminology, but in words that are different and more readily accessible by people? If that needs to happen, otherwise they may not hear you. They may not hear what you are proclaiming, and you may not be able to listen to them, maybe even worse. You're unable to listen because you can only hear these certain terms. I think it's a question for the seminary faculty in a sense, but it's also a question for you to address. And then the other thing on the level of pastoral is an encouragement to understand the need to connect word with deed and proclamation with action in the body of Christ, individually in their vocations in the world and connectedly as the body of Christ assembled in ministry. And I'm not talking now about a cultural demand from boomers who are seeking significance, because that's the way this gets portrayed. We do things to establish ministries because the boomers want us. I'm a boomer. I want this. I need significance. I need to do something significant. So find me something significant. That's not why we're doing. Not why we're trying to connect word with deed. We connect word with deed because it's a biblical mandate from the book of James, for one. We connect word with deed because it is a spontaneous action of the Holy Spirit in us, in our lives, every day. And it is the spontaneous action of the Holy Spirit upon the community and the communion of saints as well. Now, the thing I wanted to speak about at the final thing of pastoral was in service of mission. I can just say that it's so ongoing, the opportunities that you will have and that I have, that it's hard to quantify them. It's hard to know what to do and what to say in each situation. But your pastoral heart, your confessional integrity will give you the word as it comes up. I'll put you in a situation I was in the other week in Queens. I'm at a Greek restaurant. This is Queens, so it's Queens logic now. I'm at a Greek restaurant with an Italian waiter and a Hispanic busboy, and I'm eating the meal with a table full of Koreans, only one of whom speaks English, and one of them is the manager of a Japanese sushi restaurant, and the other one has trouble with a Russian landlord. Okay, and I'm trying to find what my pastoral role is in that situation. Why am I here? What do I do? Turns out they were having a wedding. They wanted to have a wedding, and they needed me to bless some things inside of the wedding. The missionary, the newly appointed missionary, was there with me, but speaks very limited English. And, you know, first thing I wanted to do was to say, can you get to Waukegan from here? And the answer is no, you can't get to Waukegan from here. You're in Queens. You're going to deal with this very multicultural situation. You're going to deal with what is your task. And my basic idea at that point in time was pray, praise, and give thanks. So I volunteered to give the prayer. I volunteered to encourage in any way I could, and I volunteered to give thanks for the situation in any way I could. And what they really wanted at that, the one thing they wanted me to do in the presence of the missionary was authorize the use of champagne in the toast at the wedding, because there was some issue as to whether the newly appointed missionary would authorize a champagne toast in the church. I had no idea that this was going to happen. Now, what do you do in that situation? Okay, what do you do in that situation? Now, we're Germans, so we're Teutonic. Alcohol are us, you know, we're not... It's not a problem for us. It was a beer toast, maybe, you know, the Heineken toast. I felt that I should give authorization, and the reason I gave authorization was because the guy told me on the side they had already bought the champagne. that's the pastoral, by the way, that's the pastoral thing to do, is say, do you have the champagne yet? Because... then the choice has already been made. The other thing underneath that, which was very, very interesting to me, was that they wanted me to assist in something that I didn't know took place. And it was, I'm not a great listener, but I in that setting I had to listen because I couldn't speak that much. And what really they told me was that at the time of the wedding, the groom, who was the Lutheran in the mix there, wanted his name changed. He wanted to have receive a Christian name at that time. And I was not prepared for that either. But they said this would be profoundly helpful for the family in beginning their life to receive, instead of the family name, a new Christian name. And so I had to invent one on the spot. So what name would you invent on the spot? They're biblical and Christian. I went with Michael. As I said, it's a strong name, it's Hebrew, it's Old Testament, has to do with who is like God, who is there like God, it's very strong. I said, and the strongest archangel in heaven, name was Michael, number one archangel of all time, fighting against the devil. And they said, we'll take it, we'll take Michael. So now we got a new Michael in the world. Those opportunities will come unto you richly and at all times in ministry. And to me, as able listeners, you will be given opportunity to make those kind of pastoral decisions. We live in hopeful times, very hopeful times. We live in times that are very similar, in my mind, to the anti-Nicene era. If we live in the post-Constantinian era, right, then we would also be comparing notes with the anti-Nicene era, which is the pre-Constantinian era. I think one of the great things I've been reading about in some books is the way the church formed and grew in the second and third century after the apostles died. And a lot of it was done behind a kind of a rolling bishop model, But the bishop had a parish. The bishop had a parish and then did sort of an outreach from that parish into the communities surrounding the city he was in. And I think one of the great debits, now to move to the presidential side of this lecture, is that this, most district presidents do not have a parish. I find this to be a tremendous flaw. I find it to be something that harms me in many cases from getting about what I see the Father's business to be. It keeps me distanced in a certain sense from regular teaching. I do regular proclamation, but regular teaching with a specific group of people is something that cannot be overestimated. And I'm sort of a troglodyte in that regard, I guess, to say, let's go. I'm willing, should I stay on in this regard, to and desirous of finding an attachment to a parish. In the same way we say this about our seminary faculties, by the way, the greater opportunity you have to have seminary faculty attached to a parish, the same thing applies to me. And I am at a loss, in some regards, a great loss for not being attached at this time to a parish. Having said that, I still have to keep working, otherwise they won't pay me. So the idea then is, what can I tell you today as a district president? One of the things I wanted to say presidentially to you is that we are committed to continuing support systems for you upon ordination and call. The PALS thing, which is coming out of the system right now, is a good start, where we will have mentoring arrangements put in place for all recent graduates, and hope to continue to do that. And I believe that support system is necessary not only from the standpoint of what you're going to get when you get out there, but who you are when you came in here. There was a certain thing in a support system that I took for granted, and if you heard my resume, my family goes back to Walther in this denomination, in this church body. I have incredibly deep ties, incredibly deep family ties, and an incredible sense of connectedness. Some of you are newer to all of this, and you hadn't come through 12 years of education in it. There's a need that you have automatically for continued support and for greater support. And I can tell you, as a district president, we intend to do everything we can to enhance that support, including financial, including not doing to you what has been done for so long, is to put you in a situation which is deteriorating to unable to pay your salary. And that's going to get me into a problem at the far end here in the conversation in a moment. And that is to say that there's a very changing face to parishes at this time. In the Atlantic District, I said this yesterday, 80% of the parishes average 80 in worship. 4 out of 5 average 80 in worship. That's a small church. Those are not large assemblies. We are the same in some regards as North Dakota. We are the urban version of North Dakota, or they are the rural version of us. Either way you cut it. And that the changing face of that makes it virtually impossible for me to do my work the way my predecessors did, which was to say, there are two routes you have. You either receive a call, you either make a call from the field, or you receive a candidate from the seminary. That's the way you proceed. You can't do that when there are 35 people in worship and an annual budget of $28,000. Can't be done. So we're doing all kinds of other things, including Delto, including deacons under supervision, including vicars in vacant parishes under supervision, including retired pastors, including semi-retired pastors, including bivocational pastors. Anything we can do to stabilize, to bring to pass the vibrant life of that parish under pastoral leadership and supervision. But it's not the same as it was. And I think, just to say it, the advertised number is always that there are pastoral vacancies, 800, 900, whatever the number is that is advertised. That's not a real number, and it should be unadvertised, because many of those vacancies are very borderline as far as calling a candidate, as far as affording a candidate, as affording a full-time pastor. And what we have done in the Atlantic District is we have, and this is a hard thing, okay? I say it to you as a hard thing. What we will do is give a candidate, we did one for a candidate 2 years ago, a booster grant, we call it. And the circuit and the district band together and make up the difference between whatever the parish has as a budget and a salary, an adequate salary for the pastor. And we'll make it a grant for, let's say, 3 years. But, now you think that through for a minute. Is anybody under the gun in that setup? Yes, you are. That's a tough thing to do. It puts limits on your ability to do your work. And they're economic limits. They're not limits on the power of the gospel. They're not limits on your personal gifts or any of that. They're limits economically set. I find that to be a very harsh reality, but a true statement to make to you this morning, that there are more places than ever that are that way and that are going to be that way as the migration and the change of patterns of movements and patterns of people moving, the demographics change. As the demographics change and move out of some of our urban parishes, they're not viable. As the demographics change in first-tier suburbs become areas of flight, that will not be less viable. At the same time, I want to say to you that we are finding a booming market for family life, so-called family life pastors, pastors who can take over in a middle-sized parish that job of nurture and expansion behind ministries to younger families in that parish and in that community. It's really more of a mission intention in my mind. And then thirdly, we are doing, and you'll see, I think, from the various districts, more emphasis on new church starts in the future. But it is not as it used to be, and it's a changing face of vacancies. Then finally, two last things. One is the PIF and SET form, which people have concerns about because it's used as sort of the Bible on you out there. When you ship one off, it is your personnel record, it is your resume, it is all of these things, unless can it adequately express who you are? Does it get at what you really believe and how effective you would be? Does it get in the way of your receiving calls because you didn't fill it out right, if there is a right? Do some get thrown in the can right away because certain statements are made? These are serious issues for you, and they lead to a kind of an insecurity. And my response to those issues is to say that the maximum amount of communication you can have with the circuit counselor or with the district president is the way to get around that. Is the way to get around the insecurity of you on a piece of paper. Because if people are, and to let you know that the real way, another way in which things get done is by word of mouth and is by people talking to one another about the strengths and weaknesses of pastors out there and about the availability and about the proper placement of pastors out there. And that's the way it should be. People get nervous about the way it should be. Why wouldn't we do that? We are in this because we trust one another, because we have agendas we share with one another, because we have directives we share with one another in life and in ministry. So my word to you sincerely is to be in maximum communication with those who deal with personnel issues and movement issues. And finally, I'll just say that one thing I see on the horizon from districts is different levels of assistance to parishes than there used to be. And the way it's happening for us today is in a customized sense, that rather than me, the old way was, we'll have a workshop, invite all of your lay people, we'll charge them up on some topic that we think is important, and they'll go back and make your life miserable. And that's a good system. No, that's a lousy system. That wasn't a good way to do business. What I'm trying to do as one district president is to have pastor and key leaders, if there are issues in their parish, come to us as a unit and say, we could use some assistance in this area. Relationships are frayed. There are certain areas of stewardship or certain directions we need to go and restructure, rethink. And then we can come in, it's sort of a left-hand kingdom thing, and we are able to come in and give help from people who are going through the same thing and have been there, perhaps to people who need some help in that regard. I see this as a real bonus kind of an area for the connected nature of LCMS congregations. Because if you have good relationships with your neighboring pastors and the laity begin to interrelate, there are great dynamics that can take place inside of that for the upbuilding of the kingdom. There are great things that can be shared, and strengths and weaknesses, whether it's fiscal or whether it's structural or whether it's planning or whether it's reconciliation, all of those things can be put into harmony by proper intervention. Once again, I think the danger has been in some of our settings an insecurity, a sense that if we ask somebody for help, it means we've got a problem. Well, that's true. And maybe it's time, I found this to be amazing in parishes I go into, is that there's a great explosion of energy once they realize it's okay to say we've got a problem. And maybe that's all about your gospel ministry. The gospel ministry of reconciliation, of forgiveness, of fresh starts, of admitting we messed up, of bringing people to the table and having them hear the weekly proclamation of the gospel in such a way that it's okay to talk about that we're not all we could be or should be, but that we're on the way in Christ Jesus. So, we live in hopeful times, we live in expectant times. I am most privileged to have been here for these 3 days, and give God thanks for each and every one of you. Thank you.